good afternoon and welcome and thanks again for finding time to be here. The elaborate introductions are over for the day. I think everybody knows who our speakers are. I'll pass out the written introductions. I just want to introduce this time just the idea of Black Power. All right, I'm just going to read you something that Zahara, when she was your age, right, had a hand in writing. This is the Atlanta Project position paper on race. It was written in 1966. 66 is the year that the Black Panther Party came to public notice. It's the year that Stokely Carmichael, with a kind of behind, and a SNCC member named Willie Ricks, popularized the term Black Power. It's the year that a lot of things come together. And in terms of articulating all of these new intellectual and political thrusts, the Atlanta Project position paper on race was a particularly important kind of document, and let me just read you the beginning and the end of that document. 1966. In attempting to analyze where the movement is going, certain questions have arisen as to the future roles played by white personnel. In order to make this issue clearer, we have written a few paragraphs stemming from our observations and experiments. Thank you, Lucy. Which serve as a preview to a broader study on the subject. The answers to these questions lead us to believe that the form of white participation, as practiced in the past, is now obsolete. Some of the reasons are as follows. The inability of whites to relate to the cultural aspects of Black society. Attitudes that whites, consciously or unconsciously, bring to Black communities about themselves, Western superiority, and about Black people, paternalism. Inability to shadow white sponsored community myths of Black inferiority and self-negation. Inability to combat the views of the Black community that white organizers, being white, control Black organizers as couples. Insensitivity of both Black and white workers towards the hostility of the Black community on the issue of interracial relationships, parentheses sex. The unwillingness of whites to deal with the roots of racism which lie within the white community. Whites, though individually liberal, are symbols of oppression to the Black community due to the collective power that whites have over Black lives. Because of these reasons, which force us to view America through the eyes of victims, we advocate a conscious change in the role of whites, which will be in tune with the developing self-consciousness and self-assertion of the African-American people. In concluding, we state that our position does not stem from hatred or racism against white people, but from a conscientious effort to develop the best methods of solving our national problems. And finally, it is a very grave error to mistake Black self-assertion for racism or Black supremacy. Black people in this country, more so than the colonial peoples of the world, know what it means to be the victims of racism, bigotry, and slavery. Realizing our predicament from these inhuman attitudes, it would be ridiculous for us to turn around and perpetuate the same reactionary outlook on other people. We, more than anyone else, realize the importance of achieving the type of society, the type of world, whereby people can be viewed as human beings. Sahara, a member of the Atlanta Project, I'm just going to sort of turn it over to you
okay.
now to sort of take us back to that moment.
Okay. All right. Well, it feels to me like it's certainly time for us to address this particularly, we're doing it publicly, for those of us who were Black and white in SNCC, to address what in fact was a very, very painful period in the organization. And I hope that we all can, share with you all both the pain, the anguish, as well as, what we think negative and positive came out of that. I have a former student who's now a colleague and a friend named Dan Berger, and he's written a very good essay, in my opinion, called Rescuing Civil Rights from Black Power. And he starts off with a quote from James Baldwin, which says, "History I contend, is the present. We, with every breath we take, every move we make, are history. And what goes around comes around. Something else that, in trying to think about what is very sensitive and painful period in the SNCC saga that I was a part of, I've been looking at different writings, and I'll be speaking about some of them that I want to bring to your attention in case you are not aware of it. But, you know, there are these collective memory theorists, and they talk about how the past is invoked to shape the present, how collective memory is a graphing of the past as it is used for present aims, a vision in bold relief of the past as it is woven into the present and in the future. Now, in the official memory, mainly sort of white historical and some black historical memory, black power was an ugly, hateful intrusion into what had begun as the peaceful, nonviolent, can't we all get along movement that white liberals could love. Black power has been greatly maligned in both the white and black media, and so has the Atlanta Project of SNCC, seen as the nest where this insidious monster was spawned within SNCC. And many authors have written about this. Now, while we and my colleagues here yesterday and today are certainly not producing a collective memory, we are sharing with you our memories about the same events in which we were active participants, who obviously have come from diverse racial, gender, and perhaps at times differing class positions. So I've been working on trying to recollect my memory from this period, and that's difficult. I mean, as I said, I think yesterday, I'm in my sixth decade of life, and as we Muslims say, alhamdulillah, but at the same time, this happened in my second decade. So clearly, you know, memory fails in many areas, and therefore I've gone back to some of the historians of this period trying to see some of the details that have now are foggy. What I do remember is a lot of the pain and the anguish that came about after we issued that paper that you've just heard a few lines from. This paper produced acrimony, it produced hatred, it produced internecine warfare within SNCC. And it was published in the August 5th, 1966 edition of the New York Times, where they erroneously credit its authorship to Stokely Carmichael. Until recently, there's been little to nothing positive written about the Atlanta Project, its participants, nor the backdrop for its stances regarding the need for whites to leave their staff positions in SNCC to develop white institutions that would take on the endemic racism and white supremacy found in the white community, which at that point we saw lay at the root of the problems facing black people. And I would say in a myriad of ways continues to affect us. So as I mentioned, I've looked at a number of things. One thing that I was very happy came out was Winston Grady Willis, who did a PhD at Emory, which is in Atlanta, focused on the Atlanta Project. He, of course, enlarged it in this book, Challenging U.S. Apartheid, Atlanta and Black Struggles for Human Rights, I recommend that to you. And of course, the Fennell Joseph book, Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, while he doesn't focus on the Atlanta Project, he certainly sets the backdrop, the historical backdrop, going all the way to the 40s and coming up to this period when Black Power arose. So and then there's a master's thesis written by a person who was at Ohio State, and his master's thesis, his name, by the way, is Jason Perkins, and his master's thesis is called The Atlanta Vine City Project, SNCC and Black Power, 1965 to 1967. So these accounts have helped to trigger my memory of the period. Additionally, the majority of the Atlanta Project staff met in 2007 for about 3 days, where we recollected together our memory on tape, video and audio tape. And we are hopefully moving toward both a documentary film and a book on the Atlanta Project, which will tell the project's story from the perspective of those of us who are living it. Now, of course, in putting together my comments, because I didn't want to just, you know, speak extemporaneously, I'm going to omit a number of things. Hopefully you were here this morning. If not, hopefully we can fill it in later. But my own story, what I was able to tell earlier today and somewhat yesterday, but just in very brief, I went to Spelman College and had no intention consciously of getting involved in the movement, did get involved, worked with Staudin Lynn and Featherstone and Cobb and other SNCC workers to develop the curriculum for the Freedom Schools, and also got involved with the planning for the Mississippi 1964 Mississippi Summer Project, decided that I wanted to go. And you heard earlier that it was a wrenching time, both in terms of my family, who really were opposed to my going out of their love for me and fear that I would be killed, and also my their disappointment at me dropping out of school. Now, I spent 17 months in Laurel. Many things happened. As was noted this morning, I became the project director. The first building that we had, which was one we pretty much rebuilt, and had our school there and our library and other things, this was firebombed, and the fire department let it burn down. For a while, we were operating on the back porch of Mrs. Clayton's house. That was our office, because people were afraid to rent to us for fear of their property being destroyed. Then we finally were, after the summer project was over, there were two women and myself, three of us who remained. They were white, two white women and myself. They were from California. And then later, two young men joined us from Hattiesburg, who were high school students who had been kicked out of school for their participation. So that became the Atlanta Project, and we finally were able to rent a little three-room shotgun duplex. And we were in one side, but there was a family of five in the other side. Now, the Klan put a firebomb under the gas line. Clearly, their intention was to blow the house up. It didn't matter that a man and his wife and their children were sleeping next door. But also the two young men, Charles Hartville and Ulysses Everett, who were high school-aged people, they slept in the house. And, of course, it would have killed them if the plan had gone through. Anyway, as fate would have it, the bomb, the explosive, whatever it was, blew the gas line away from the house, and it did not blow the house up. Anyway, the house was damaged, but we continued to pay rent and operate out of it. Now, one day, we used to get all kinds of things sent to us, boxes of, you know, books and clothes and toys and things to distribute. And in one of the boxes was a 78 RPM record, and we of course had a little small record player, and it was Malcolm X. Now, you know, because I'm from the South, I really didn't know about Malcolm and had never read any of his writings, or not had I heard him speak. I think it was his message to the grassroots. But anyway, I was there, the other folk were out doing various things, and I put that record on. Well, I'd never heard anything like it. You're talking about shock and awe. That's what I initially had. I was riveted, electrified, jolted, you name it. I was frightened by it, but empowered by it at the same time. And in an interesting way, it was an antidote to what I was feeling at the time for myself, for the staff, for black people in Mississippi. What we were going through and had gone through, what had happened in Atlantic City, I had begun having doubts about the tactics and all that we were using. I was angry. I felt that black folk were so vulnerable here, and this speech was like a joke. I thought, oh my goodness. And I listened to it numerous times while I remained in Mississippi.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you. I want you at this point to say something that you sort of skipped over or slid over in the earlier presentation. You were saying that the volunteers who came down were very difficult to manage. Right? Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think that's okay. More of this context.
Okay. Well, certainly, and I mean, all right, the thing is that, you know, and first of all, anyone who came down has to be, I think, affirmed and lauded for just their coming, caring enough to come. But I think that if you have any sense of the apartheid Jim Crow South, where, you know, blacks and whites have lived very separate lives, and in the North, you have the same thing, even though, you know, it's not as overt, but it's still two nations, you know, minimally two, one black, one white, never the twain shall meet. So you have, you know, we had 19 white volunteers. One of those volunteers, just to show you the economic level of some people, he was a Goodyear tying rubber. You had, you know, people from Yale, from Princeton, from Columbia, and you know, these were white suburban young people who had never ever lived in a black home, been with black people, and certainly not poor people. Or, you know, you had racism operating, you had sexism operating. The fact that I had been made the project director and was the same age, in some cases younger than them, trying to keep our little ship on course for what we were trying to do, and we did a lot. But we also sometimes would spend all night in consciousness raising. I mean, I didn't know the term then, so I didn't know what we were doing. But I was like, you called Mrs. Jones, who's 85, Mary. You can't call her Mary. And they were like, why not? She told me that was her name. I said, I know, but she's never going to tell you I'm Miss Mary to you. You got to understand that that's what you're supposed to say. You know, this is Miss Mary. I mean, you know, you have to treat her with respect. Well, I'm not disrespecting her because I call her by her first name. I said, yeah, but this is the South, and, you know, it's a little different down here. When you put handle on a person's name, it lets them know you respect them. Or, you know, people accepted that, you know, the Freedom Riders are here to help us, et cetera. You know, people wanted to invite us to their homes for dinner. And I mean, you know, this is a big group to be trying to feed. So, you know, we would get there, and of course, you know, what little few chairs there may be. It was like the white folks got the chairs, you know, we could sit on the floor, and it was like, okay. And then they got the best food. I mean, if it was chicken, you know, they got the drumstick, they got the you know, we might get the feet or the neck if it was any left. And it was sort of like, you know, this was grating. I mean, you know, we were all there facing the same dangers, not to mention. And so this kind of thing, and I would suggest, not only myself, Jimmy Garrett, you know, and I would say, well, didn't you think that maybe you should have not just grabbed it because they offered it to you? I mean, so we had really stuff like that. I mean, then we had to deal with the whole issue of, you know, sex, and hey, all women are off limits here. I mean, listen, we got a history of white men and black women. I mean, we're not going to have any of that here. Do you understand? I mean, so, you know, I mean, you're going to be out of here. So I don't care if they're flirting, if you think they're flirting, no. That's off limits. No way, no how. So, you know, it was a lot of stuff to try to deal with. And so you're also trying to stay alive and trying to help them stay alive. And, you know, for the longest, you know, people didn't understand how dangerous it was. You know, don't go walking off somewhere by yourself, girl. You know, I mean, stuff like, please wear underwear and under slips. I mean, come on now. You're in the black community. The white folks think that every black man that sees you wants you. Please don't look like you're advertising. Come on. I mean, we're talking basics. You know, it was heavy. And look, I mean, you know, I was 19 also. So anyway, we had sometimes we would talk all night long trying to get to it. And often we absolutely were able to communicate and people did get it. But it was, this was a part and parcel of it. So, in addition to that kind of experience, I guess the thing of nonviolence and the violence being perpetrated against us and wondering, you know, was that really going to lead us where we were trying to go? I think the fact that, you know, one of Malcolm's famous statements about how can black people afford to be nonviolent when our churches are being bombed and our little girls murdered. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff was, I was hearing it really deeply. Okay, clearly I was influenced by Malcolm from that point on, as were other members of the Atlanta Project. And I think that how Joseph describes Malcolm as laying the ideological foundation for nothing less than a political revolution by blacks who sought to control their own destinies really did, I think, over time in the project as we discussed things, that's how we saw his thought at that time. So, what was the Atlanta Project? It was an urban community-based project established February 1966 to serve as the headquarters for the re-election of Julian Bond, who, though he had been duly elected from what was the 136th district in Georgia in September of 1965, had not been permitted to take his seat in the Georgia State Legislature. And this was because SNCC had issued a public statement against the war. Julian was the communications director, and in that capacity, his name was on the statement as it was sent out to the news media. So they used that to say, you know, SNCC is anti-American, Julian is anti-American, he has no right to be sitting in the Georgia State Legislature. So now, while the project was set up in Vine City, a part of his district, one of the poorest areas in Atlanta, we initially certainly went there to get that vote out. But, you know, we were in a little ramshackle house in Vine City, surrounded by the most incredible poverty and despair. And so we couldn't just be about trying to get Julian reelected. We then got involved in the issues on the ground. And so in many ways, this was SNCC's first urban project that began tackling the very issues that we are still struggling with today. Inadequate housing, huge unemployment, you know, health care disparities, terrible educational systems. I mean, you know, this is the stuff we're still dealing with. And then on top of that was a tremendous low morale and depression. So in addition to organizing a rent strike against one of the worst landlords in that area, also getting involved with workers who worked for cleaners, trying to help them get a better wage, and then when they all got fired because they were trying to get a better wage, then we set up pickets. So we were engaged with that community. The other thing, and I credit Bill Ware was the co-director. He and I were co-directors. And Bill had been to Africa with the Peace Corps. He was older than us. He'd been in the Air Force, a second lieutenant. He'd done a lot of travel. And so he, I think, was more in tune with some of the strands of nationalism in Africa, and he saw the African Americans in America as sort of an internalized colony, and that we needed some of the same kinds of liberatory activities that people who had been colonized in Africa and the rest of the third world. So one of the things we embarked upon was a mass consciousness building effort that included a newspaper called the Nitty Gritty. We also would have like dance parties out on the streets where we'd play music and, you know, hand out leaflets against the war, against the draft, and just talk to people, you know, barbecue. I mean, just to get the people to come out. So we were, you know, really trying new tactics in an urban area where people basically were totally disillusioned, had no faith in anything was going to help them out of their, out of the horrible systems in which they live. Now, tension existed between the Atlanta Project and the National Office of SNCC almost from the beginning over the role of the project, because we were turning ourselves into much more than the Julian Bond reelection campaign. Then a $3,000 check came for Julian Bond's campaign, and it was sent to 142 Vine Street, which was the headquarters, not to 360 Nelson Street, which was the national headquarters. This is really when the shit hit the fan, because we decided we were going to keep it, and that we were going to put the money in an Atlanta Project account, because we were always begging for money from the national office to get the Nitty Gritty out, to get the Atlanta Black Paper out, because one of the things that we did was that we did mass leafleting for months downtown in what was called Five Points, Atlanta. And this was the place where all the black women who worked in white folks' kitchens had to come from the black neighborhood, come to downtown Atlanta, get on the buses that would take them to the suburbs. I mean, there were literally thousands of women and some men who worked out there. So we,
going to Buckhead.
So we started doing a flyer a day that would talk about the latest, you know, numbers of killings in Vietnam, how many American soldiers had died, how many were black, you know, how many Vietnamese had been killed. Then we would juxtapose that with stats on what was happening in Atlanta, what was happening in the federal, in the nation that black folk weren't getting, and what those dollars being used in Vietnam could do. And we would wear all black. We had heavy veils on because we were in mourning. So the women were veiled, and because it was all women that would do the actual demonstrating and handing out the leaflets. So we were really experimenting with new ways of getting to urban blacks. And it I mean, just one quickie about that was people were so into that that if we were late, we would get cursed out. People said, I missed my bus because I couldn't leave until I got my flyer for today. Why y'all late? You know, and we were like, I'm sorry. And they said, well, I'm going to be late getting to Miss Ann's house, you know. So anyway, this really caught on. All right, so we decided that in order to keep the $3,000, that we were going to develop a rationale for it. And that is what became the Atlanta Project paper, because we were going to say why we needed the paper, I mean the money, to carry out the work we were carrying out. Now, the original paper was 65 pages long, divided into three sections, but it's really only the first part, which provided the group's ideological framework that has become famous. And it was in that section that we attempted to address charges that we were racist in reverse, and we addressed that some even drew parallels between us and the Ku Klux Klan. Now, this is because we had already started saying that SNCC needed to be a black organization. And it's very important to realize that one of the things that happened after the Mississippi Summer Project was that a lot of the white young volunteers who had come wanted to remain in SNCC. You know, as you've heard from Fanny, this was a life-altering experience. And so at this point, believe it or not, the Atlanta office had maybe as many as 70% white staff. And there had already been some real tension between those of us in the Atlanta Project who decided that we were going to be an all-black project and suggesting that that's what needed to happen with SNCC, which I now, of course, not then, understand how painful that was for many people, much more so for those who had been with SNCC, like Bob, like Sue, over the long haul, even though Sue was always working sort of in the white community, except for the time that you mentioned. But the real tension, I think, was really between what we in the Atlanta Project saw as the organization being taken over by white liberals from the North. So in the part of the paper that has become famous, infamous, if you will, we did draw from the ideologies of Malcolm X, Francis Fanon, Kwame Nkrumah, and others. And the central theme focused on the issue of white participation in black organizations and the problems that their presence caused at the time. Now, one of the things that I didn't mention that happened in my experience in Mississippi was that if black folk came into the office and there may be three black people there and there was one white person there, generally, unless these people already knew us and knew the project and all, they assumed that the white person was in charge. And so they would go to that person for the information that they wanted. And so often that person would have to say, oh, well, you need to talk to Gwen or this one or that. So we and others who were in the project who had worked, like Aisha's dad, Michael Simmons, had been in Arkansas. Others had worked in Alabama and places. All had experienced this same thing. So we attributed this problem to the pervasiveness of racism within our country and how it had impacted on whites and blacks alike, because blacks had internalized the racism. Now, I think you have some fragment of this online, and one of the things that I had hoped to do earlier and forgot about it was to have this more lengthy excerpt, which appeared in this book called Modern Black Nationalism from Marcus Garvey to Louis Faircon, which has much more in it than the Joanne Grant book. So we pointed out that due to this pervasiveness of white supremacy, it was not possible for the whites who worked in black communities not to bring their sense of superiority into the project, nor was it possible for blacks not to have feelings of inferiority given the long history of white supremacy, slavery, Jim Crowism, etc. We also addressed the pain that our position would cause the long-term whites in the movement, many of whom we were totally aware had made as many sacrifices as we had. And we asked the reader to consider what we were saying with an open mind, and here's a quote. Be responsible about what you're reading. Consider at every moment of your presence in the black community the effect that you're having, what tensions are created by your presence. Evaluate your role. Are you a part of the solution or are you a part of the problem? We also noted, and I think that's one of the pieces that you just read, Charles, we were charged that black power is no better than white power. We wrote, black power is a practice that empowers the African American community at no expense to other groups, while white power or supremacy empowers the white community at the expense of other groups, particularly African Americans. We argued that SNCC would be able to attract more blacks, especially poor and uneducated blacks, to its ranks if it was a black organization. Now, I'm not going to give you the other quotes, but this paper was presented at a staff meeting in March of 1966, and it was soundly rejected by the persons representing the national office staff. Things got really hostile at that meeting. The meeting had been called to discuss the $3,000. We went in with the position paper saying, we're not talking about the $3,000 till you read this paper. So we pretty much made them read the paper, so you know there was a lot of anger about it. So they said, no, give us the $3,000, and we wouldn't. So then, you know, we left in a huff. Now, the position paper ignited issues such as the role of whites and the direction of SNCC. In fact, the paper forced the organization to reassess its organizational goals and philosophy. The impact of the position paper on the organization was most clearly seen at the national staff meeting held in Kingston Springs in May of 66. And the election of Stokely Carmichael as chair of SNCC. When we gathered there, the paper had spread throughout the organization, and there had been a lot of discussion about its content. And many staff who didn't necessarily agree with everything that we were promoting, that they did feel it was time for SNCC to focus less on forming interracial alliances or alliances with the Democratic Party, which John Lewis was being really pillared about, and that had something to do with him being put out of the chairmanship, and that we needed to focus more on building independent black political organizations, as Stokely Carmichael and the people in Alabama were doing in Lowndes County, with the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. So in May of 66, the SNCC meeting articulated the first official shift towards black nationalism and opened up the space for criticism of the current leadership, which included both John Lewis and Jim Foreman. Even old guard SNCC folks like Ivanhoe Donaldson, a very prominent member of SNCC, he even encouraged the organization to embrace nationalism, including community-based political movements, and to forge alliances with the Third World. With Carmichael at the helm, SNCC embarked on a direct course toward nationalism. And so it was at that Kingston Spring meeting that SNCC decided to change the leadership at the top, to embrace nationalism, development of community political entities that would struggle for political power where possible and to actively forge alliances with the Third World. Black power was not new to the African American lexicon. Close approximations of the word go all the way back, and the actual term had been used in that formulation by Richard Wright, by Paul Robeson, and by Adam Clayton Powell. SNCC folk in Alabama had used the phrase black power for black people before Willie Ricks and Carmichael screamed it out on the Meredith Challenge to Fear march begun on June 5th. It was meant to signify the creation of independent black institutions in general, but specifically ones like Carmichael and the staff in Alabama had organized in Lowndes County. It also affirmed a more positive affirmation of blackness. And you know, one of the things that when we start kicking black power around, you know, it's hard to now not remember. I'm not sure what I'm saying. Anyway, it's hard to remember that when I was growing up, when you call somebody black, you could get hit in the nose. I mean, you could be black as my shoe. And if somebody called you, and I am wearing black shoes today, if somebody called you black, those were fighting words. I ain't black. I ain't black. Don't you call me black. I mean, so, you know, I remember, and it was mentioned earlier, when I got an afro, you know, the dean called me in and said, "What have you done to your hair?" And I said, "I washed it." She said, "Don't get smart with me. You know what I mean. Spelman young ladies will not go around looking like that." I mean, we had so many things to deal with. The self-hatred, and another thing that could get your nose bloody was to call somebody an African. "I ain't from Africa." And you know, Malcolm X spoke to that. He said, "You left your mind in Africa." So, you know, these things, you know, it's so common now. You know, we got locks, we can wear our hair any kind of way we want to, and it's not necessarily a comment on your mental state. You know, I know that after this period, I wore African attire all the time for years. I mean, you know, so it was like, and my mom was like, "Girl, what are you doing wearing those clothes? I mean, you know, what, you know?" So we had a lot to deal with. That black power is just a word, but it meant so much. Now, Carmichael first used the term on June 16th in LaFleur County after being released from jail, in which he was talking to about 600 people. He told the crowd, "This is my 27th arrest, and I'm not going to jail anymore." He said, "The only way to stop white men from whooping us is to take over. We've been saying freedom for 6 years, and we ain't got nothing. What we are going to start saying now is black power." And of course, Willie Ricks jumped up on the stage and called out, "What do you want?" And the crowd yelled back, "Black power!" Of course, the people loved it. It tapped into the pent-up rage people felt about the slow progress and the continuing violence and oppression that blacks continued to live under. The media, of course, ran with it. And somewhat, unfortunately, the rest is history. History that, unfortunately, is not known, the true history, and rarely discussed rationally. Bill Ware says that black people embraced this term so readily because it broke the fear blacks had of white supremacy. They used it, blacks did, to dismantle their fear of the white landowners in the rural South and the white police in the urban areas. As, of course, many blacks and most whites didn't embrace it, they opposed it as racism. So not only did whites react hysterically, but so did black leaders, more specifically Roy Wilkins of the NAACP. He was the first to condemn the term, contending that black power meant anti-white power. Going even further, he said it was a reverse Hitler, a reverse KKK, and the father of hate and the mother of violence. Several civil rights groups issued a statement entitled Crisis and Commitment, which appeared in the New York Times. They vigorously condemned black power. They said it was militant, it was threatening. And of course, the New York Times editorialized that we were calling for violence, that it promoted an anti-white sentiment, and yet it had no viable organizing program. Okay, lastly, it was at the SNCC meeting at Peglet Bates' establishment that SNCC voted to expel the white members of SNCC from the organization, and I think someone mentioned this before. It was a vote of 19 to 18, but then you had about 28 extensions. So that shows you people were very ambivalent. It was very, very difficult. But white participation continued until May of 1967. The Atlanta project of SNCC was disbanded in the beginning of 67, ostensibly over a car that we had been assigned, and we were told to bring the car back, you know, and we didn't. And so they actually called the police and reported that we had stolen it, at which point Bill Ware was fired and the rest of us resigned in protest. In retrospect, I do not now agree with all of the tactics used by the Atlanta Project, nor by the National Office staff. I think both of groups overreacted at times, and we developed such animosity toward one another that it became impossible to communicate. We both drew lines in the sand and refused to budge. It's a miracle that no one died, because we certainly threatened each other. And at some points, we all were armed. At that time in the history of black struggle, much of what we wrote about was true about the endemic and systemic nature of racism and how it had affected all of us, black and white alike. I think the paper and the discussions it generated made SNCC and other groups, black and white, take a more hard-eyed and realistic look at what we were up against in this country. All ethnic groups that have been successful in carving out a piece of the American pie had developed power in different spheres of life, be it in their labor unions, their police positions, in their stores, or what have you, while blacks had been systematically barred from practicing these same efforts. As I've already said, the Black is Beautiful movement developed from this point of view, the Black Arts movement, the creation of independent black political formations grew out of this, and a reinvigorated black theology, very important, and we don't have time to go into it, but certainly that's one of the areas that I teach. The effort to get blacks elected to office was a part of this, as well as the many black formations that arose and fell during the period after the rise of the Black Power movement.
An extraordinary piece.
Great.
An extraordinary piece, and I want to just talk about something Charles and I have talked about, because I think that what you are covering is such an important part of our history. It's as important as the civil rights movement. I don't consider this the civil rights movement. I think it's the beginning of the black liberation movement, which we really don't talk about, because what we want to do is to say And it was a different period. I can't speak too clearly to it because by 1966 I had lost my mind in working, and I had gone to Mexico to live because I was just absolutely worn out. I couldn't think about things clearly. And part of the reason that I had gone was because, very much like with the Atlanta Project, in the summer of 1966, I became obsessed with this idea of establishing a residential freedom school here in Chicago. And what had already happened was that we had opened a freedom center on 43rd and Cottage Grove. And I was the quintessential black idiot, right? Because I was there, the Freedom School Project had become such an obsession with me. I wanted to do good in the community, right? I wanted to give back in the community. A community that in many ways I was as alien to, because in my biography, I talked about the fact my parents were both from Mississippi. The home that I grew up in was much more, the way I was socialized, was much more in terms of the South than it ever was of the urban North. I mean, this was something that was completely alien. So there I wander in, wanting to do good. And in wanting to do good, completely, unfamiliar with the reality of the community. And so one of the things that happened was I did not understand the nature of gang life as it was developing in an urban area. I had all of these feminist learnings and yearnings that had come out of SNCC. And had developed a relationship with a young woman who happened to be the girlfriend of the gang's war counselor, right? Well, I didn't even know what a war counselor was, right? And I kept telling her that she did not need to be beaten by him. She did not need to have him as a pimp. Mm-hmm. And I was working this, and this young woman was the daughter of a prostitute who most nights was put out while her mother was working. See, oh, you black idiot, my goodness, you know. And so I can certainly relate to the title of the seminar. Not knowing what I was doing, resulted ultimately in the gang feeling very, very threatened by the presence of the Freedom School, and the gang coming in and deciding to take over the Freedom School. And it was a night of terror, which in many ways was part of the premise of the Freedom School, was to try and link the struggles of the South and the struggles of the North, so that people could come to understand that, you know, it wasn't a movement going on in the South, but that there was something different going on here. And so that's what we had been talking about in the Freedom School when the gang arrived well armed and held us, myself, Judy Richardson, Sharon Jackson and John Love, the four of us who were doing the Freedom School. And it was a question of nonviolence versus violence. It was a question of North versus South. But what it forced us to do was to look at some issues in a very different way. It forced us to ask some questions about what kind of change were we really trying to make. But this was not a question of equality. This was not a question of integrating schools. this was really, for us, what we began to see beyond the question of race was liberation. And that in order to be liberated, yes, you had to understand racism, but that you had to understand some things beyond that. And so this whole period that I say is that of the Black Liberation Movement really begins, I think, when you start to move into urban areas, when you start to ask questions about the tools of the movement, the Southern movement, how effective those tools are in the North, what kinds of questions do you have to ask? How do you organize? Is it the same way? Is the organizing in the churches as much of it was in the South, or is the organizing in the street? Do you have to work in taverns and bars? And do you have to work with gangs? And if so, how? And so there are questions that I think began to be raised in that period. Were questions that took us far beyond the ones that we had been addressing up until that time. It started to, for many of us, to put this in an international, a more global format than we had been working with. When Holly was talking on whatever day that was, we were talking yesterday, about the analysis of racism by white groups. Once we moved into this period, the whole issue of Black versus white once again showed up, because whites believed that if we're going to address race, we are the ones who should control that dialogue. We are the ones who should analyze it. And so you can talk about SDS, and you can talk about PL, and you talk about the October League, and all of these white groups who now feel it is necessary to analyze Black power and explain it. Okay? And this is just a continuation of the dialogue that had been going on that had been going on since before the Summer Project about the role of whites in the organization. I mean, it comes to a head in the discussions around the Atlanta Project. It finally blows up at Peglet Base, but these questions had been going on the whole year. Bob, you can probably speak to this better than anyone. The whole year before the Summer Project had been engrossed with the question of whether or not to bring whites, and if so, what was that going to mean? And in this Black liberation phase, at that point, where organizations began to say, no, we are going to control this dialogue. We are not going to be told what Black power is. We are not going to be told what white racism is. We're going to analyze that ourselves. And for that reason, the whole Black power period is extremely important, not only in terms of what is accomplished politically, and let's face it, Black power was indeed the basis for, in the next few years, the political takeover by blacks in urban areas. Hatcher and Gary, Carl Stokes in Cleveland, those things would not have happened had Black power not began to illuminate for people what the possibilities were for controlling their institutions, for controlling their thought. Now, as Gwen just said, whether or not there are mistakes that are made, of course they are. And the interesting thing about the presentation that she just made is the multi-layers of it. And in the Black Power, Black Liberation phase of the movement, no, people aren't singing songs anymore. No, people are not holding on to each other unless you're trying to get somebody's gun away from them, right? And so it is a very different and a very, I'm sure from the outside, frightening, very, very different from the earlier phase, but so extremely important because at the moment that you start to look at this experience, and I want to go back to this, I said it the other day, when you start to look at this experience as, even if your stance is as a nationalist, when you start to look at this experience and say, how am I connected to Africa? See, Stokely doesn't remain at the same point where he starts. That's why you have to look at life in its entirety. Stokely is not the same person in the writing of Black Power as he is in Ready for Revolution. Because regardless of where he started out, when you start to look at Africa, you know, if it's something other than looking at it as coming to America, then you start to see all of the complexities of Africa and how is that relating to the Black experience. Again, you know, when Amés de Serre died 2 months ago. And de Serre, who is the foundation for Fanon and for Said and for all of the things that that come after that, when he dies, he is still struggling with the president of France, who now says, you know, well, colonialism wasn't so bad. Look at what it did for the Africans. Let's, you know, think about this and reaffirm this in a different way. So Serre says, no, no, he's 93 years old and he's dying, but he says, you know, this is the same fight that made me leave the French Communist Party because of the inability, the failure to address racism. And so when it started to, I know I'm going on a little bit too long, I'm going to just cut it off right now. All I want to say is that what Black Power did is it taught within a national context the ability to control your own institutions. It forced people, because of what you were looking at, to analyze things in such a very different way and to nuance our understanding of Black oppression. It certainly led to this connection with the African liberation movements and the foundation of a very, very important analysis, a non-European Marxist analysis of the world. And so Black Power is pivotal. The Atlanta Project is pivotal in that it leads SNCC from all of that training that we got in the early days of the movement and prepared us for a new phase of struggle. So thank goodness that we're talking about the Atlanta Project as
publicly.